You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel.
Coming up this week in episode 253, the National Park Authority has launched a campaign to get people to say hello to each other when they're out walking. Sad that people need reminding to be pleasant. Oh, but they've spent £35,000 on it. That's a good idea. Is everything in sport up for sale? And with yet another event cancelled, what is going on at all tomorrow's parties? Anyway, that's all coming up after Todd Rundgren and Love of the Common Man. Oh, now Todd, just because he drops his H's and enjoys a game of darts.
Buying this album when it was released in the UK, it feels like yesterday, but was in fact 1976. The masterful Todd Rundgren from his album Faithful and Love of the Common Man. Yo, and as they say, what's up?
Sorry.
Hello, welcome to podcast episode 253. I imagine I'm Terence Stackham, and certainly not a common woman.
I'm not sure how true that is, but thank you anyway for your contribution.
It's Juliet Harris.
Hello, everybody. Yeah.
Jules, before we reach out for the menu of the day, we'll be talking about Prince later, but very sad news this week with the death at the age of only 62 of Victoria Wood.
Yes, I was very, very winded by this. I we've talked about Camilla Long and her grief priest before, haven't we? And you know, whether or not you can truly feel heartbroken at celebrity deaths. But I was surprised at the depth of sadness I felt about the death of Victoria Wood, because I realised what a key part she played, well, really, in my life and my thinking on things. You know, she dinner ladies I will talk about until the cows come home. You know, she's done amazing things. Actually, one of the good sides of Victoria Wood, one of the only crumbs of comfort I had during the afternoon, because I was very sad about it, was the fact that one of my best friends from university, who were in sort of sporadic touch because we both had quite busy lives, we were big dinner ladies fans, to the point where when we finished our final exams on the last day of university, before we went out for the evening, our celebration was to go back to our house with a couple of other housemates, order a Chinese and watch three episodes of Dinner Ladies on the spin. We were big fans. And she texted me when it broke and said, oh, I thought of you. And you know, several friends that knew how much I loved it texted me, because, you know, Victoria for me was she changed comedy forever. She was the first female stand-up to really break through. And she you know, had her own way and view of looking at things. She brought not only female voice but also a northern voice into comedy, and you know, the thing that I love about her is that she's got this supernatural ability to understand how people talk to each other, just how people talk in everyday life. I don't think anybody apart from Alan Bennett, but he's not her generation, has her ear for dialogue of ordinary people, not, you know, RP people. And also, she seemed to understand the emotional battles that underpin life, and she was able to do that without being sentimental. She was, you know, she was just, you know, a genius, I think, really. And I am terribly, terribly sorry for us all, selfishly, but obviously for her friends and family, that she's gone. They re-showed a tribute to her that they'd done 2 years ago when she was still alive. I think they showed it on Thursday evening on the BBC, called Victoria Wood Seen on TV. That was a sort of a tribute to As Seen on TV. And I don't think I've laughed that much in years. I'd seen it before. And the thing that really sort of saddened me was they had all of her sort of repertory company / friends on there. So they had Judy Walters and Celia Imrie and Duncan Preston and Susie Blake and all of the people that you'd associate with her. And part of me thought, gosh, how are these people feeling now? Because, you know, the whole thing was a sort of like a tribute while she was alive. And, you know, I Judy Walters' short statement that was only one sentence long was you know, just really upsetting. And I think that Judy Walters said her loss is incalculable. And I think that sums it up, really.
I know the Daily Mail is an easy target, but Thursday's Daily Mail front page headline really made me seethe. This was the headline: Victoria Wood loses secret cancer battle. Now, firstly, she didn't lose a battle with cancer.
Yes, we talked about
it. She died of cancer.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a secret, it was private. Yes, there's a considerable difference.
Absolutely. Someone posted. They weren't the only, to be fair, you won't find me defending the Mail very often, and I'm not going to do so properly now, but they weren't the only paper that did that. There were two or three papers that used those sort of secret cancer battle phrases. And someone tweeted, oh, I fixed these front pages for you, and using sort of paint or whatever it is, had crossed out secret in every headline and written private in block capitals. And I completely agree. You know, like you say, the Daily Mail is an easy target. Having said that, I don't have any problem in the Daily Mail being an easy target, because they see lots of other minority groups as being easy targets. So as far as I'm concerned, you know, do the crime, do the time. So yeah, really, as ever, the Daily Mail proves itself and other papers prove themselves to be undesirable organisations. But anyway, let's move on.
Yes, on a little bit of a lighter note. Earlier this week, I was in a short queue in the bank trying to use one of their irritating touchscreen machines. This is now the only way you can pay in checks these days in many branches at Barclays. I don't know if it's another bank.
I bank with Barclays, and you know, I often find myself fighting to speak to people.
Oh, there's hardly any staff in there at all now. And it takes forever, and you can guarantee that at least one of the three machines is out of service. And anyway, in the queue, I inadvertently made eye contact with the woman in front of me.
Oh, this wow. And now you're married, and that's the main thing. Oh, no, hang on.
And that's the end of the story.
Yes,
no, so on that flimsy basis, she felt obliged to make conversation.
This is not your thing, I'm beginning to sense.
Oh, it's a moment. Well, it's a moment I dread in any circumstance, Jules. Anyway, she said, she was quite warm today, she said. And I don't know, for some reason, it took me a few seconds to kind of think of a reply. And those 3 or 4 seconds just felt like an eternity for both of us. It was just an awful moment. And then I managed to think of, hope it lasts.
Wow, zing.
I know, yeah. And she sort of smiled and raised her eyebrows and said, yes. And she gave a little ironic laugh. And so I felt obliged to say,
oh, no.
Well, this is England after all.
And it's also a bit cheery, isn't it? How nice, yes.
She gave another little chuckle. But luckily, we were rescued by one of the stupid machines becoming available. But it was as each of us was following the worst script ever written, saying what the other expected to hear. And it isn't even true. I don't really like sunny weather, so I didn't want the sunny weather to last. I quite like cloudy days.
Yes.
All of which leads us to, in this convoluted way, to the South Downs National Park Authority.
My local national park, by the way, fact fans.
Exactly. Yes. And it's blown $35,000 of taxpayers' money on a campaign to teach people walking on the South Downs to greet each other with cheery hellos and hi theres. They include in this $35,000 an excruciating, absolutely excruciating YouTube video. Now, Jules, if you go out for a stroll on the mean streets of Hastings, do you want every soul you meet to engulf you with their how are you doing and you're there, have a good day?
Well, one of the disadvantages of living in the town in which you grew up and that you've lived for about 24 of your 31 years is that most people do that anyway because most people know who you are. So sometimes you don't have to be, it's almost like being a famous person with none of the benefits of being a famous person because I know a lot of people. And so quite often, you know, if I was to walk into St. Leonard's today, I would, you know, I'd probably bump into somebody I knew. But maybe that's a bit of a different thing to strangers saying hello. I was brought up by parents who, my dad was a very, very keen bird watcher for years and is now very much obsessed with moths, which is, we can talk about that another time. That has its own social...
It's like a Bertie Wooster character.
He's a bit like sort of David Bellamy, except not quite as irritating, really. But we used to go for lots and lots of walks as a child, probably, you know, around the South Downs, lots of woodlands locally in Sussex, you know, that sort of thing. And I was always, always brought up to say good morning to the people that were, or good afternoon, depending on what time it was, to the people walking opposite. So actually, this has sort of been, I've been brought up into this tradition, so I can't quite claim to have the antipathy that you do. But it does seem a little bit... a little bit sad that you know, that we have reached this point where people either are having been educated to say hello to each other or that we feel obliged to say good morning to each other. I'm quite happy with an enigmatic half smile most of the time.
Yes,
that's an in-between, isn't it? You're acknowledging, you're sort of, my friend calls it waving your face at someone. You're kind of acknowledging the fact that they are there, but you're not really having a chat. You sent me a link to this. The Guardian have an article called Pass Notes, which is always done as a sort of a question and answer thing. And much of this made me laugh very much. Name, hello, age, dead at birth. Yes, quite. They said people say hello to each other at the time, to which they reply, and maybe you find yourself in this situation, Terence. No, they don't. They avoid eye contact and pretend you're not there and bump into you because they're too busy playing Candy Crush to see you. Presumably, this is a problem you find all the time. The first time I ever experienced Candy Crush, by the way, was seeing a girl waiting for the same tube train as me playing it and overlooking her shoulder and going, oh, so that's that thing that people plague me to within an inch of my life on Facebook to play when I don't want to. And that's another thing we could talk about. But yes, according, going into the detail on this, they've said this Share the Path campaign for £35,000. £8,000 of this was spent paying employees to wear bright clothing and walk around the park and disrupt the tranquility of the surroundings by saying hello to strangers. Oh, I, God. I, I don't want to say hello to someone in a high fizz jacket. I feel like you, you know, I've probably gone to escape other people. I don't really want to say hello. Also, the aforementioned video was 11.5 grand as well. And presumably the remaining 5.5, 6.5 grand was sort of, you know, quote unquote admin. But they said the video didn't go very well. They said the lead character just walks around the park with his dog trying to get conversations out of people. It makes him look desperately lonely. The slogan at the end might as well be, come to the South Downs, there's tons of serial killers here. It wasn't massively vibey, was it, really, that video? I say hello in circumstances that are appropriate. I probably, unlike you, am more likely to veer towards small talky than I am not small talky. So in that sense, any conversation we did have in real life might be a bit awkward, but we do know each other, so we probably would be able to circumvent the, oh, isn't it windy out? Yes, you know, I've had to unpeel my face from the bonnet of my car type conversations. I'm more inclined towards small talk. I'm more inclined towards chatting and being friendly towards people, because that's just kind of how I've ended up. Most gigs that I used to go to by myself at university, I would meet people and you know, sort of chat with, because that kind of feels like a natural thing. But equally, to spend all of this money, to spend £35,000, I don't know if that's public money or not. I'm not sure, you know, what the National Parks Authority, what their level of grant, what their level of spending is. So I don't want to get into wasting our public money, because I don't know if it is or if it isn't. But it does seem a little misguided, doesn't it, really?
I think common sense has to prevail, because I agree with you. In my small village, if I'm out for a walk, people do smile or say good afternoon or whatever. And most people know each other, as you say. And it's a genuine warm acknowledgement. Yes. I'm okay with that.
Yeah, that's lovely.
Of course,
yeah.
I'll say hello back or good afternoon, whatever. But it doesn't work. It's the enforcing of it. It doesn't work if you're trying to cross the road at Oxford Circus.
No.
And I even think, you know, one thing I consider about this, it might worry some people. If you're meandering along the South Downs Way and some stranger, and sadly, I think it does make a difference if you're a bloke, and particularly if that bloke is on his own, a huge cheery hello just doesn't feel right. I think if there was a woman coming towards me on the South Downs and I happen to be on my own, and I think I would be worrying her if I suddenly stopped and said, hello there, how are you?
Yes, that's a bit...
It's all down to circumstance.
Yes, I'm inclined to agree.
Has sport sold its soul to the devil one time too many? In this case, the devil being BT, Sky and other TV networks. That's next, right after Toots and the Maytals.
Sing it up, mister! Hear what I say, sir, yeah. No, yeah. Get your hands in the air, sir. Woo, yeah. Then you will get no hurt, mister. No. I said, yeah.
Oh!
And the Maytals, 54-46, that's my number, though I did experience some number confusion about this when texting Terrence earlier in the week, and he thought that they'd done a follow-up called 64-46 due to my bad typing and tired brain. But that was 54-46, brackets, that's my number, close brackets, by Fred Toots Hibbert, recorded by Toots and the Maytals. It was released on Pyramid over here. There was a follow-up. Did you know this, Terrence? There was a follow-up released as well called 54-46 Was My Number.
Oh,
I
no.
know, I have never heard it and I don't have any desire to. But yeah, it was released twice in 68 and 69, the original. So
that happened when he switched from BT to Virgin Media or something, and they you know,
yes,
they had to
exactly.
change its number.
Yes, the number formerly known as 5446, yes.
Exactly. Jules, earlier this month, one of the UK's most well-known horse races, the Grand National, it found its race time moved to 5:15 in the afternoon to suit the demands of the television company that was broadcasting it. Now, to be fair, this worked out well as the race was watched by 10 million people, an increase of 1.1 million from 2015. In fact, it was a remarkable 59% share of everyone watching TV at the time.
That is large, particularly for something that's not new, is it, really?
Exactly. and particularly in this case on Channel 4, which was still considered something of a minority channel. Now, as part of the £5 billion television deal that starts in August of this year.
That's a lot of money, isn't it?
Hell of a lot of money. There will be Premier League football matches on a Friday evening for the first time. And I can't say in all honesty that I'm disappointed with this news, as an evening without football on the telly feels like an empty evening.
And also, for those of us snazzy young people that are popping here and there and also don't have Sky and won't set out to Sky during the day, Friday afternoon, if Friday evening, if BT Sport got a few of those, I quite like to sit and watch a bit of football, having my dinner on a Friday night. That sounds ideal.
Absolutely. As part of this five billion television deal, by the way, I received a letter during the week from my cable company, Virgin, telling me that my subscription to Sky Sports would indeed go up yet again.
Oh, good.
In July,
yes.
Endlessly veering upwards. But, Jules, we're getting close to the point now where sport may as well just hand over the keys to television and let TV run it officially.
Yeah, I'm inclined to think that, to be honest, and to the point where no one really makes a fuss anymore, do they? So it always used to be kickoff in the Premiership was always at 3 o'clock. And then they started having late kickoffs, so sort of 5 o'clock, and people whinged, didn't they, and said, oh, it's not proper, it's not how it used to be. And then they have Monday night matches, and people started to complain. And we still do occasionally, to be fair, have complaints. Some of the FA Cup scheduling has come under fire, hasn't it? Because there was one particular match that was scheduled to start an hour after the last train to Liverpool, or wherever it was, had left back. And that still makes me really, really angry. And so, they have been complaints about that, but the complaints are more about the specifics of it now than they are about the general principle. Friday nights, and that's the thing, it's like the telltale slip to drug addiction. Once you've done one thing, then the next thing afterwards becomes, as she said in the Daily Mail reactionary way, the next thing afterwards becomes less of a step. And like you, I agree that it seems like because sport has been so beggared about with by TV, it seems like there doesn't seem to be a limit as to where it's going to end. I mean, talking of the Grand National, I remember that it was a really, really... The year that they had to postpone it because of the terrorist alerts, was it 94, 93? It was early 90s, if I remember correctly. They then... Didn't they do it on a Monday afternoon or something? They did it
rings a bell.
Yeah, they did it during the next week, and that was sort of, oh my god, you know, it's on a Monday. What are we going to do? You know, it was really kind of, you know, moving the national was a really, really sacred thing. And now I know it's still on the same day, so it's not the same. But now no one really seems to. I wonder. This is a thought. I wonder. We say, oh, it's a shame that sport is completely, you know, is giving away the keys to TV. I wonder, A, how many people watching it actually mind or care. We've just both said it would be quite nice to see Friday night football matches. And B, whether this is indicative of the fact that maybe sport's got itself to blame in a football sense by pricing its tickets so high that people now can't afford to go to matches, and so, you know, the power's in our hands as consumers because we're the ones that watch it on TV because we can't afford to go and watch it at a football ground because they've priced themselves out, and see whether in fact, you know, if we're, you know, whether that should be the, you know, whether it should be like that, whether, you know, sport has to accept that it is, you know, a product now and that's how it is. And you know, and that actually as a consumer I have a right to want to consume things. As a millennial, as we talked about previously, I have a right to consume things when I want to. I don't know.
Yeah, I pick up on the thing that you said there, which I think is absolutely key. I think we may reach a tipping point where there are almost empty stadia because everything is geared up to the TV audiences and nobody cares about the people actually in the stadium. And yes, you're right. We already get football matches rescheduled for TV viewers, leaving, you know, for example, 10,000 people from Newcastle trying to get home from London at 10:30 in the evening, or of course, the reverse, thousands of, I don't know, Bournemouth fans in Liverpool in the left to find routes back to the south coast in the dead of night. And I think it'll only become an issue for TV when Premiership grounds are half empty. But even that, it seems to be, it's secondary to them because they seem unperturbed already. I've seen sides at the top of the second tier of football, the Championship, battling out midweek games in stadia echoing to the sound of empty stands. And I'm thinking maybe in 10 years, all of the crowd will be like green screened in. You know,
absolutely.
Digital supporters with sound effects patched
in. Isn't that peculiar? That feels a bit dystopian for me. I'm not sure if I'd be entirely comfortable with that. But then we've spoken previously about test matches over in India and Pakistan, haven't we? Which literally have about 10 people watching them.
Yes.
So I don't know. And maybe then we'll realise that part of what makes sport what it is often the atmosphere of the crowd in the ground, isn't it? That's often a bit of a... I mean, we talked previously, I think, about the response to the terrorist attacks in Paris, and then England played France, didn't they, in a friendly fairly shortly afterwards, and the whole crowd sang the Marseille beforehand. And that's not something I will ever forget. So maybe it would be a pity to be losing out on those moments.
Yes, absolutely. Digital supporters, sound effects patched in by diligent robot audio engineers. There's your future. All tomorrow's cancellations coming up after Natalie Williams and This Girl. out touring this summer and promoting her new album, but that track was from her 2006 album Secret Garden, the delicious voice of Natalie Williams and This Girl.
That is lovely. Thank you for picking that. It's a cracker, I think.
Yeah, I think she's got a lovely voice. Jules, although the internet has streamlined the buying of concert tickets, rarely now do we need to queue up outside a physical box office, the scope for incompetence from promoters still looms large. Here's a small example. Just over a week or so ago, I went to see the band Vaults in London. And on the afternoon of the gig, we realised we needed extra tickets. So I phoned the venue and asked if there'd be any tickets for sale on the door. And a very pleasant young man apologetically said, "I'm sorry, the gig was sold out," left us in no doubt at all, no extra tickets. And then about 30 minutes later, and I don't know why I did this, but I just rang, instead of the ticket line, I rang the general number rather than the ticket line at the same venue. And I just asked the same question. I said, "Oh, yeah, any tickets left for Vaults tonight?" And a different person said, "Oh, sure, there's loads left. Just turn up. You'll be fine."
Oh, and, goodness sake.
And as it turned out, it was fine, and it was far, far from sold out. Now, you know, that's just hapless incompetence, but you have a deeper story to tell.
Yes, indeed. Well, All Tomorrow's Parties is a thing that's been going on. Well, sort of indie nerds will know, but just to try and explain this for people that aren't as ridiculous as me, there was something that was put on by Belle and Sebastian, the band, and it would have been about 98, I think, called the Bowley Weekender, which was at Camber Sands Holiday Centre, so it was local to me. I was too young to go and will spend the rest of my life regretting this. But, you know, it was a huge success. The idea of an indie festival in a holiday camp, so you could see bands like Belle and Sebastian and also play mini golf, that does sound like my ideal holiday. And it was a huge success, very much talked up in the music press at the time, which was far more of a sort of a breathing organ than it is now. And so as a result of which, a chap called Barry Hogan, who was running a London-based promoter called Foundation, decided they were going to put on a festival at the same venue called All Tomorrow's Parties on September the 17th and the 19th, 1999. And a friend of mine, a journalist called Stuart Huggett, posted this earlier in the week as a response to the latest cancellation. This has been happening. The first ever All Tomorrow's Parties festival was cancelled due to poor ticket sales in 1999. This is from the NME, dated 18th of September 1999.
17 years ago.
Yeah. And it was due to be headlined by Stereolab, Tortoise and Shaq. Foundation blamed the poor ticket sales on festival fatigue, the requirement of having to buy tickets in groups, because the way that ATP often works is that you buy tickets for a chalet, so your accommodation is included. Mm. So you buy chalets in groups of 4, 6, 8 or whatever. So that is occasionally a bit problematic, although they have done much to work around that. And the fact that many of the headlining acts were scheduled to tour around the UK at the same time as the event. So you think, okay, not terribly well organised, but, you know, presumably they'll get over it. ATP have a very long and colourful history of cancelling things, to the point where in 2012-ish, they liquidated themselves with debts of over £2.6 million. Looking at the debts that they owed when they went bust, they owed £2.6 million. They owed debts of from £90 upwards owed to 63 different companies, including £11,000 to the Union Chapel venue in Islington, which is run by a charity, £36,000 to the organiser of Primavera Sound in Spain and Portugal, where they host a stage. They owed Portishead £30,000 for doing "I'll Be Your Mirror," which, again, one night was Portishead, one night was PJ Harvey. It was at the Ali Pali, I think. Mm. They owed £352,000 to Butlins. They owed £1.5 million to two ticketing companies for loans. You know, they owed money all over the shop, basically. Basically, the first, if you go through all the different registered companies that Hogan has done stuff under, the first one had to be dissolved 2 years later in May 2001 after the second ATP, claiming that they were ripped off by a business partner that took £80,000 out in cash and ran away, and that they never quite recovered from that, which is true. I do have sympathy for. But basically, ATP have a very long and colourful history of owing people money, of cancelling things. There was a festival in 2014 called Jabberwocky that was cancelled the day before. So everybody that had organised, people had flown over, band. There are bands like Hookworms complaining on Twitter that they still haven't been paid after Jabberwocky. I have friends that still haven't had their tickets refunded from Jabberwocky. And the problem is that they seem to be completely incapable of cutting their coat to their cloth. It is wonderful that someone wants to put on these weird kind of indie bands and often bands from the States. There's no one else really doing that. And I think there is genuinely a market for that. But the problem now is that they seem to have got themselves locked into this sort of death cycle where, you know, me and my friends have been making wry comments all week about, oh, I see that Barry Hogan's Rubber Check fiasco tour has been cancelled again. You know, they have such a terrible reputation for not paying people. The most recent cancellation was, it was meant to be this weekend. One of my best friends, and this is why I'm so blood-curdlingly livid about it, it's almost like having a friend that's in a bit of an abusive relationship. I keep saying to him, Neil, stop buying tickets for ATP stuff, it's going to be cancelled. And he said, yeah, but every time we've gone to stuff, it's been really good. And there was the one being curated by a band called Drive Like Jehu, and the boat behind them, Rocket from the Crypt, and all that kind of stuff. And it looked a really good lineup. And Neil tried to persuade me to go, and I didn't, on the basis that A, I was busy, and B, I thought, well, this is a bit hooky though. Will this not be cancelled? And so the weekend before, Stuart Lee was doing one at Prestatyn. The Drive Like Jehu one was meant to be there as well. It had already, there was rumours that it had been cancelled because Pontins were telling people it was cancelled because they hadn't been paid. At which point, All Tomorrow's Parties then turned around and said, oh, it's okay, the payment's being made today, which is probably the least reassuring statement I've ever heard. They then decided they were going to move Drive Like Jehu up to Manchester. So Neil and all his friends, you know, were then having to make new arrangements to get up to Manchester. So the weekend before the Stuart Lee one, a promoter friend of mine was saying on Facebook in the afternoon, I know at least two bands that haven't been paid this weekend. The Fall have only got 20% of their fee for headlining. The bands for next weekend are being told now that it's been called off, but they haven't told the punters yet. So I texted Neil and said, look, I think you need to brace yourself. I think it's going to be cancelled tomorrow. And then sure enough, on Monday, middle of Monday morning, it was cancelled. Quote, not financially viable. ATP have been making the same excuses for years that their events are not financially viable, but not before taking people's money beforehand. And I'm sick of this. I'm sick of, you know, people like Barry Hogan, who doesn't appear to have any sort of conscience at all, you know, continually cancelling things, continually taking people's money, making the same whiny excuse every time that, oh, you know, there are too many festivals, it's too hard. ATP are an established name. They've been going, as you say, for, you know, 17 years. You know, their festivals are doing better than ever in Britain because there are so many. You know, live music is the only way that people seem to make a living out of music nowadays. Stop telling people that it's not financially viable. Part of the reason why it isn't financially viable ATP is because people have seen through them. People have stopped, you know, people have stopped giving Barry any time. I hope now this is the end of Barry and all of his friends, because, you know, it makes me so cross that, you know, because people like Neil, who continue, because they like the ATP name so much, are continuing to support them and being ripped off at every turn. Interestingly as well, just one more point and then I'll stop talking. Stuart Huggett put this post up, and a friend of ours, we were chatting about it and said, why do we think the wheels have fallen off now? And our friend made a very interesting point. He said, yes, but when things were continually being cancelled in the late 90s, early 2000s, we don't really have social media to talk about, do we? We didn't have social media to bitch on. And what the ATP is a victim of now is that it's continually running at a loss because it keeps cancelling. It keeps biting off more it can chew and cancelling things and never recovering from that. And rather than just going, no, stop, we'll take 2 or 3 years out, we'll try and recoup our losses, you know, we'll try and, you know, sort everything out. It's in a position where it's trying to put on more and more things to make the debt back, which it then needs to cancel because it can't do it properly. And people are getting spooked. This is the problem. People get spooked because there are rumours on social media, and then you think, you know, and they keep going, oh, it's all right, guys, everything's fine. It's almost like, you know, some sort of low-level pot dealer. It's all right, guys, I'm good for the money, just give me another week. And that doesn't wash anymore in an age of social media, in an age of where you can go to any festival in the UK, there are tons of them, and have a good experience.
It's impossible to disagree with what you're saying. I think what's so distressing is that even if ticket holders get their money back, that's not anywhere near the full picture. I think you said when the company went into liquidation in 2012, it owed 2.6 million. I just scribbled down, I think you said, to its creditors. And that's such a simple word, creditors, isn't it? But it encompasses, you know, cleaners, suppliers,
absolutely,
staff, You know, staff at junior levels, caterers, I suppose, people running small businesses is what I'm getting at. And that's why my key point with this is I believe we need to sharpen up the rules when a company goes into liquidation. Everybody deserves a second chance in life. Of course they do. But if a company goes down owing money, the owners shouldn't simply be able to start up a new company the next day and carry on as if nothing had ever happened.
Which is what they've done several times. And actually, I'm just reading an article. I'm finding Vice.com, the website, increasingly interesting in its kind of scope of journalism. And it's got a music dedicated site called Noisy, spelt with an E in Noisy, irritatingly, because they are millennials. But anyway, and they've made the point. When I was speaking earlier, some of the info I got earlier is from an excellent Stool Pigeon article, which is worth Googling. But they've pointed out from that Stool Pigeon article, ATP haven't turned a net profit since 2007. And so they liquidated in 2011, 2012, but they haven't been making any profit for about 5 years. And it gets to the point where, you know, maybe ATP have a point. And this Noisy article makes the point that quite a lot of the bans they were putting on to people like Neutral Milk Hotel, quite a lot of sort of, American bands, you know, like Mudhoney and Dinosaur Jr. and stuff like that, lots of us love those bands, but they are still a cult concern to some extent. And maybe, you know, as noble as it was at heart to want to put on these kind of festivals celebrating the underground and the weird, maybe they were never going to be massively viable because there just wasn't the idea of it. But there wasn't the support for it there. But I don't know. But there is something in the point that, you know, the kind of stuff they're trying to put on is not viable. And, you know, aren't they good for trying to put it on anyway? Well, yes, it's nice that audience is catered for. But equally, if it's all it's going to involve is throwing good money after bad and ripping everyone off on the way. I mean, you know, cancelling something the day before, cancelling Drive Like Jehu the week before when people have booked flights to come over from America. One of the bands that meant to be playing were trapped in Europe and had to start a Kickstarter because they've flown over to Europe to play the gig, and their flight home was the money they were getting paid to do the gig, and of course they haven't been paid, so you know there was a Kickstarter, and I think I can't remember who it was, but I think they've got home now. A friend of mine is putting on Quintron and Miss Pussycat in Brighton this evening, this Saturday the 23rd, because they are now in Britain and have no gig to play. I mean, you know, there are lots of mini gigs going on this weekend because people are over, and ATP have said they will refund people's expenses, to which I reply with what? You know, if you haven't paid half the bands that have already paid, where are you finding this money from? You know, it's and you know, maybe to some extent, you know, yes, you know, it is know what they're trying to put on these events, but you get to a point where you have to say stop, surely, because there are so many, you know, victims now of this. Like you say, you know, small cleaning, you know, small companies. When you looked at the list of the debts that they owed at that 2.6 million, the smallest one started at £90. So, you know, it's a shocking enough that they own charities like the Union Chapel 11.
So they could be pulling down other businesses all around.
Absolutely. Who rely on them.
Can't afford to suffer that debt.
And also can't really afford the time and the expense, even if you go through small claims of trying to sue people to get that money back, to which you feel. And when I used to do litigation back in the day, our first rule that we always used to say to clients, even if they did have a good claim, was yes, but it has the defendant got a pot to pee in? Are they worth suing? Because if you sue them and you get a judgment saying that they were wrong, yes, hooray, good, they owe you the money. But but where do you go with that? How is that judgment going to be enforced? Have they got the money to pay you back? And that's, like you say, that's also enraging, the idea that, you know, my friend that's bought a chalet for four people and asked for a refund then they've all booked hotel rooms and a friend of mine's tried to cancel three hotel rooms up in Manchester. And the hotel won't have it. So he's been saying on Facebook, who wants a free hotel room for the weekend? Because I can't cancel it. You know, it's but people like that, if you're owed £200 by ATP, you know, that's not small change for a lot of us. But is it really, really worth the faff of trying to take ATP to a small claims court for money which they probably haven't even got anywhere, which is why it's all been cancelled? So I wish firms like people like ATP, who, you know, trying to present themselves as being alternative and outsider and cool, I wish they'd just stop taking the pee, basically. I'm angry for my friend Neil and all of my friends that were really looking forward to it that can't go. I'm angry for the bands that, you know, in most cases are cult bands. bands. It's not like you're U2 and you can afford to take the hit. The bands that play ATP are, you know, flannel clad outsiders that, you know, have taken 2 weeks off to cut off their day job to come over and play this. And, you know, I do think that Barry Hogan, you know, he's not on my Christmas card list.
If you want to talk to us about this or any of the other topics we've mentioned this week, the easiest way to do so is on Twitter at SuperJules84
yes.
for lovely Juliet and at Sir Terence for me. Jules, live appearances.
Yes.
I think you've got a live appearance coming up as well as your radio gigs.
I have, yes. In terms of appearances, World of Juliet, for people that can stay awake long enough to be interested, we're recording this on Saturday, the 23rd of April. It's the Saturday social this evening. We have got hooray, we've got to E in our A to Z, so we're doing an hour of E this evening, 6 to 7 p.m. barricaderadio.com. I also put things up on my Mixcloud as well, which is the Mixcloud channel is mixcloud.com/Juliet letter L Harris, or you can just search the stuff on there. Indie Wonderland is back next week. We may or may not have an interview with a band, but that's back on Wednesday the whenever it is of April. You probably need more detail than I do. Wednesday the 27th.
Yeah, that's right. Yes. Again, referring to my Chelsea desktop calendar.
Every home must have one. Chelsea supporting or otherwise. I suspect increasingly most homes are otherwise, but I do see
it. Yes.
Yeah, indeed. So not the team du jour anymore, one suspects. But anyway, yes. Yeah, so next Wednesday, 8 till 10, barricaderadio.com. Next Thursday, the 28th of April, I'm DJing at the Lovely Eggs, who are a band that are playing down in Hastings at the Carlisle. So if you want to shuffle along that you can. And then Friday, the 29th of April, me and my Sheila's Take a Bow DJ partner Letty will be DJing at the Dragon Bar in Hastings Old Town. So should you wish to come and say hello, you have ample opportunity to do so.
Range of
opportunities.
Absolutely,
yes.
Yeah. Thanks to Rona on her Brawee Island. And,
yes, indeed. All power to Rona.
All power to Rona. And, of course, thanks to you for listening. Jules, there's a handful of gigs over the years that have stayed fresh in my memory as... I don't overstate it, but I really do mean life-enhancing experiences. There was David Bowie at Hammersmith back in 1973 when I was a wee boy. And more recently, Kate Bush, also at Hammersmith. Mm. That was in August 2014. In between the two, I'll never forget Prince at the O2, August 31st, 2007. One of the most blistering and moving music performances I've witnessed. True to his eccentric ways, this was bizarre. He played in the round and he was brought to and away from the stage in a large black box, like an enormous flight case. And they wheeled him on and wheeled him off. And then the door opened and then there was Prince. He did a couple of hours, went off, came back, did two songs as encores, got wheeled off in his big wardrobe. Came back, did two more songs. Now, this is where the house lights went up, and maybe over the course of about 10 or 15 minutes, maybe 90% of the crowd left. But I'd been given a tip-off to stay, and there was a gap of about 30 minutes, and the security people didn't ask us to leave. They invited us right down to the front, and then after about 30 minutes, boom, here came the people pushing the big black box affair. And there was Prince back on stage, and he did about another hour.
Wow.
All for about, I don't know, 1,000 or so of us who'd stayed on. Absolutely incredible night. Apart from his outstanding band, which, by the way, included Cora Coleman Dunham on drums. She had a really small woman, and yet she had drumsticks that were like baseball bats. Absolutely amazing drummer. Probably one of the most amazing drummers
I've
ever seen.
He was very good at female drummers, wasn't he? Because Sheila Rhee, of course, famously was one of his people as well.
And we had the great songs and the wonderful sort of atmosphere. But I would say he produced the greatest live guitar work I've ever seen. And I've seen plenty. I've seen them all. So a terrible loss to music and creativity. Jules, one of the songs he played as an encore that night in August 2007 is the song you've chosen to play us out with.
Absolutely,
today.
Yeah. And for me... This does sound like it's off topic, but we are going somewhere. I saw Pulp Fiction for the first time a few weeks ago. I don't know how I'd reached this stage in my life with having not seen it. And I was concerned, because I'd seen other Tarantino films, and particularly later period Tarantino films, I was very concerned as to how women would be treated in his films and whether he'd get women, because he is very blokey and it's all very brash and violent. And I wondered how he would treat women. And actually, having watched Pulp Fiction, I realised how good Quentin Tiro was in that film at just understanding understanding and writing and getting women and getting the relationships with women and men. I was really surprised by how good he was. And equally with Prince, you know, all of the love, sexy stuff. I've always thought a little bit about Prince at times. Oh, you know, he does bang on about sex a lot, doesn't he, really? Is he really going to get women and you know, is he going to be able to see women as people? And actually, Prince was magnificent at, you know, using women musicians, deliberately using women musicians, encouraging female talent. I saw Leanne LaHavis a few weeks ago, and she was a big protege of Prince, and she was one of the people I thought of when the news broke that he died so suddenly. And he was also enormously encouraging of people that wanted to cover his work. He was very anti having stuff of his on social media. So there's very little Prince on Spotify or YouTube. There's very little out there. But he was always happy to sanction people's covers. So you know, he was happy that his or him covering other works. So he had, you know, he did Creep by Radiohead, and you can get that online. It's great. And he's brilliant. And he was very encouraging of women particularly covering his work, I think. Shaka Khan, I Feel For You, I nearly picked and didn't, but it is fantastic. And one of the covers that was the most famous cover that you know, he really, really seemed to support and said it was magnificent. This is Sinead O'Connor. I think this is one of the all-time great interpretations of another person's work. I do think that she brought something to it that was just incredible. And this is, to use Prince's lovable numbering, lettering, writing, Nothing Compares to You.
It's been 7 hours and 15 days since you took your love away. I go out every night and sleep all day since you took your love away. Since you've been gone, I can do whatever. Take away these blues, 'cause now
You have been listening to a DACA Media production.